Good morning. Welcome to the last day of Microsoft Ignite. Hopefully, everyone had a good time at the party last night, and you're ready to hear about Azure hardware. So the cloud server infrastructure team is responsible for all of the IT equipment, all of the servers, all of the storage inside of Microsoft's data centers. So not just Azure, you know, but everything that we have. our team is based out of Redmond, and we're very happy to have gone down the path of producing hardware and open sourcing our hardware to the Open Compute Project. And so if you want to, you know, buy our hardware, the same hardware that we use, you know, we can get you that hardware through the Open Compute Project. So let's talk more about what we've got. So I wanted to talk about the cloud in general and the hardware that we have to build. So it starts with the application. So Microsoft has a very broad reach of applications. We've got more than 200 different types of servers, or not types of servers, types of applications. You know, we've got Bing Search, we've got Office 365, Exchange, we've got Azure, of course. Inside of Azure, you've got storage, you've got premium storage, you've got high-performance computing, you have a SQL database, you have Data Lake. There's all sorts of different types of applications that we need to meet. It is not a one-size-fit-all cloud. And that's one of our big challenges, is how do we build a system that is modular and flexible to be adapted to our needs. Another interesting impact to our servers is that we are worldwide. We have data centers, I believe there were, 23 or 39 locations announced just for Azure by itself, but we are located all across the globe. And when you go across the globe, you have differences in power cords, you have differences in rack heights, you have differences in rack power, you know, elevations, big differences. And so what that's done is it's driven us to create as flexible and modular systems as possible so that we can meet those different height requirements, those different power requirements, the different power cords, cooling, that sort of thing. So we also have to meet all of compliance, you know, safety, you know, electrical, EMC, all of that. All of our equipment is certified for use anywhere around the globe. So when we think of the cloud, it's not just the servers, although the servers are cool, they're my favorite part. The cloud is really a large system. Everything has to work together. It all has to work harmoniously so that we can keep the service up and alive. And so the data centers, obviously, are where we store the servers. You know, that's where everything operates, that's where things run. But the network is what ties it all together. So we have a very, very high performance network backbone of fiber inside of the data centers, and not just inside of the data centers. You have regional networks, you have dark fiber, you know, going across oceans. That's what really pulls the cloud together. But there's also operations as well. So we have over 1 million servers in our data center today, or our data centers today, and we have to keep everything up and running. So we have different strategies for operations. There may be some places where you usually repair equipment, but you don't necessarily need to repair equipment. There's other places where you need to repair equipment quickly. But in the cloud, you know, especially applications that are born in the cloud, you know, they're designed to be software resilient to hardware, and we try to tie that in with the operations. But the operations is very important as part of the standardization across all of these, you know, these million servers across the different geographies, you know, across the world. So let's start by talking about the data center. So when we started this journey, you know, back in the 80s, I believe, data centers had what they call a power utility effectiveness or efficiency of 2.0 or more. That was the norm. What that means is that metric, PUE, is the amount of power that is fed into the data center divided by the amount of power that actually goes to the IT equipment. So when you have 2.0, that means half of your power is going to run chillers, it's going to run UPSs, everything except the actual IT load. That's bad. That's very inefficient. But that's the way the state of the art way back when we started. When we were leasing colos, everything was actually pretty inefficient. And then we went off and we said, okay, we can do better than that. Generation 2, we started building our own data centers. We got down to just a 50% overhead, so like a 1.5 PUE on average. And so that was a huge improvement at the time. But we, you know, data centers are expensive. It's a lot of electricity, a lot of power consumption. We need to be efficient. And so we continued to build the data centers more effective. So Generation 3 brought in what we call containment. That's where, you know, like originally you just have racks of servers and you had forced cold air coming under, you know, into the cold aisles underneath the floor, blowing up into the servers, and then the return air would go out somewhere out the top of the ceiling. But what happens is that all the kind of the warm air and the cold air all kind of mixes together and you actually lose efficiency that way. And so when you go into containment, you start saying, okay, I need to close off the hot aisles. I need the hot air just to stay where it's at, and the cold aisle, keep those separated. They don't mix. You don't ever waste any type of cooling. And so that brought us down to a much better efficiency. You could see down to 1.2 PUE was the best that we had there. That's just a 20% overhead in the data center for cooling and UPSs. But still, we thought we could go further. Okay, we added containers. We called them IT packs. So they're like IT, I forget what it's called, but these big containers, they come in on semi-trucks. They drop them down with cranes. And the idea is that you create a very small contained space so that the air doesn't need to move very far. You don't have to spend as much electricity moving air around. We also introduced what we call adiabatic cooling at the time. That's like if you go to a sporting event and it's really hot, especially down here in the South, and they have these misters, right? They got the misters and you walk underneath and it feels nice and cool. That's an adiabatic process. The same technology that we use in the data centers to cool things off. And that gets us down to about a 12% overhead and efficiency. But that is about the best you can do when you're just buying hardware. What we needed to do was to take it to another step. We needed to standardize our interfaces. We needed to create a very tight and efficient interface between the IT equipment and the data centers. And that's our Generation 5. So that's when we introduced the Open Cloud Server, the hardware that Microsoft has designed itself and had manufactured. And we created a standardized infrastructure, very efficient, very low fan power. And that was able to, you know, that allowed us to take the energy efficiency to a new level. Okay, we have instances where we're even down to just 7% overhead. So we started the journey of more than 100% overhead, and now we're down 7, 10, 15, I think it says up to 19% overhead. So that's quite a journey. So I'm going to talk some more about the data centers and the impact that these changes to these data centers have actually had on the servers. So when you look at a data center, you know, provides three functions. The first is that it provides a place for the, you know, for the equipment to sit, right? But then it provides electricity, and it provides cooling. And so those are kind of two halves. So your traditional data center, everything has to be highly reliable, has to be redundant. So the electricity, you have dual redundant generators. You have dual redundant UPSs, you know, battery rooms and that sort of thing, you know, because if you have an outage, you know, it takes down the whole data center, right? So you can't have that. On the cooling side, you have redundancy in all of your chillers. You have these cooling towers. You've got, you know, water pumps. You got water going all over the place. You've got distribution units where you do air exchangers, what they call the crack units. And, you know, moving water around, water's heavy, has a lot of mass. It takes a lot of energy to do that. And so the first thing that we did, I said, when we introduced adiabatic cooling, we said, let's get rid of the water towers. Let's get rid of the pumps. You know, let's just replace the crack units with adiabatic air handlers. We actually do take water up to these units. They're like fiberglass mesh. And you soak them down with water and you pass air through it. And it picks up humidity. You know, just kind of like the misters at a sporting event out at the stadium. And so it picks up that humidity and it drops the temperature when it's really hot. But the rest of the year, you know, when it's not really hot, you don't need to do that. And it turns out in most climates, maybe not here in Georgia, but in most climates, you know, that this is enough. You don't need anything more than this. So that was one of the big steps in our PUE improvement, in our efficiency improvement, got us a 25% improvement, but also it reduced the cost of the buildings by about $4 million a megawatt. So you look at some of these data centers, you know, you have a megawatt of power, maybe 10 megawatts of power, you know, you just save $40 million. That's a lot of money that you save. That's something that's a huge deal to Microsoft. So, but what are the implications of going to free air cooling and adiabatic cooling? The first implication is, you can see the chart there on the left, is that you no longer have a nice, even temperature. You know, like in your house, especially in the south, when it's really hot, you know, you have your thermostat set and your temperature just goes up and down by a couple of degrees. Now, we can vary our temperature quite dramatically. What you see there is an actual screen capture of a data center from this summer, where the temperature actually went up to somewhere around 90 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, that's pretty warm, but, you know, goes up and down, you know, between 70 and 90. And the servers can tolerate that, no problem. You know, you put in a dynamic fan control, so the fans ramp up, you know. But you only want them to ramp up just enough. You don't want them to ramp up too much, because then you lose efficiency when you crank up the fans too much. But we've also had some research studies. You know, we published a study in 2011 where we discovered that hard drives, the failure rate of hard drives goes up exponentially as temperature goes up. But it's, you know, if you can just keep the temperatures at a nice moderate level, it's not a problem. And so what we have to do is we actually have to be very careful and deliberate in our server designs. We have to make sure that the hard drives don't get too warm. We have to make sure that the fans don't spin too fast, because you might just say, hey, just crank the fans up, your hard drives stay cool, then you reduce the failure rates. But if you do that, then you start blowing too much air into the data center. When you have a contained hot aisle, we've actually had cases where every once in a while, you know, you have a firmware bug. Whatever their software, there's always a bug lurking somewhere, right? And, you know, we had a firmware bug where all the fans just ramped to max. and they blew the doors off the containment center. It just created so much pressure. You know, you have all these, you know, racks and racks of servers just all trying to blow air in, and the, you know, it just can't get it out, and that's a problem. And so we have to be very measured on the amount of air that we push through the servers. We have to be very measured on making sure that the component temperatures remain low. But we found it's just a nice engineering problem. It's really not that difficult. It just requires a lot of testing and a lot of attention to detail. So another implication that we have is that, you know, we add humidity to the air. And so the data centers, the temperature goes up, but also the humidity goes up. And these are outside kind of the you know, your traditional data center that all, you know, people used to just take their data centers nice and cold and keep them cold year round. Well, we let them get warm and we let them get moist. And so what we found, what we need to do is we need to take all of our connectors and drive them through certification processes so that we can select connectors that do well in our data centers. And so we show an example there, a picture from one of the tests which we've done. I think those were DIM connectors, ran at 80 degrees C at 80% relative humidity, way far beyond anything that we would ever see in our data centers. But you sit and you bake them in that environment, you can see it's just fog inside of there. You bake them in that environment, and then you go out and you dissect them and you see how they did. And so you can see that the connector there in the picture in the middle shows a connector with only 15 micro inches of gold plating on the connector. You know, all these connectors, you know, a lot of times you'll see the connectors, they look shiny, you know, gold color. Well, that's because it is gold. Gold does not oxidize. But underneath the gold, they have nickel and other metals that do oxidize. So you have to make sure that the plating is thick enough that there's no pits that make it down to the nickel, which will then oxidize. So that connector in the center actually had a couple of little pits that all of a sudden, poof, oxidized and created what they call a bloom of stuff. And stuff. The funny thing is that if you actually have a DIM plugged in and you get that, you can see there's still quite a bit of room on that connector where there's gold. But where the oxidation happens, it goes and it builds out, it grows out, and what it does is it pushes the pin back, and the pin moves away from the DIM connector, and then all of a sudden you lose contact. And so it's not actually the oxidation, you know, creating, you know, it's not oxidation getting in between the contact, it's pushing the pin away from the DIM connector itself. And so it's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting phenomena. But again, we find it's not really that difficult to meet these environments. You just have to choose the right components. So let's talk about the UPSs. You know, you need reliable power. The data center needs to stay up. Your equipment needs to stay up. So today you've got dual redundant generators out there, and actually what we'll do is we'll set up a pool of generators. We'll say, well, if you need, let's say, 5 generators, they'll put out 6 or maybe 7 generators, because every once in a while a generator just doesn't start for some reason, and they can switch over and that sort of thing, but you only count on maybe 1 or 2 generators not starting. But on the UPS systems, these are big battery systems. And, you know, a lot of times those are also completely redundant, because you can't risk letting all of the data center go down, because it takes time to start a generator. So it can take 30, 40 seconds to get a generator up and running. Usually they start up in 7 or 8 seconds. Sometimes it's 12. But if you have the case where a generator starts up, or tries to start and it doesn't start, then you got to switch over to another generator. Then you're talking 30, 40 seconds to get your generator online. And in that in between time, you rely on a UPS of some sort to keep the equipment running. And so, in many of our data centers, to improve our efficiency further, what we've done is we've gotten rid of these UPSs, but we pushed that need for a battery out to the IT equipment. We built the batteries right into the servers. And so we built what we call LESS. It's a local energy storage. Okay, we took our power supply, we made it double the thickness, and we add batteries into the second half of it. And when you eliminate those big battery rooms, you see that picture in the center of a large lead acid battery room, you could reduce your initial CapEx by a factor of 5. It also improves your efficiency by up to 15%. That's quite a bit of efficiency improvement, and part of that efficiency improvement is saving the amount of energy it takes to charge the batteries. When you have a data center level UPS, you have to reserve, like a good 10% of your power just to recharge the batteries after you have an outage. So let's say the power goes out, you switch over to generator, you're on the UPS, generator's up and running, now you got to recharge the batteries. It can take a good 10% of your power budget to recharge the batteries, because you got to get them recharged within a certain period of time just in case it happens again. For instance, you have, like the other night we had these thunderstorms rolling through. It takes the power out. A lot of times, they'll crank, if you lose power due to a lightning strike or something like that, they'll crank up the generators and they'll run them for a certain period of time until the batteries are recharged, and then they'll switch back and hope that it doesn't happen again. But you have to reserve that power for it. When you move the batteries to the servers itself, the servers can actually siphon a little bit of the power off the top. And if we're taking too much power, we could actually, add an algorithm to drop the power of the servers just a little bit and siphon that power off and recharge the batteries locally. But you can only do that locally. You can't do that at the data center level. Because most of the time at the local level, you'll find that your power actually isn't 100%. You may be running somewhere below that, and so it's easy to just pull the power off and recharge the batteries. So, of course, if you don't need the could you use the microphone, please?
So, with local energy store, how long can the server run on these batteries?
On these batteries, we design them for 45 seconds to a minute, somewhere around there. We actually have quite a bit of redundancy in there, so we usually get like a minute and a half. But when we time worst case, our generators coming online, usually they're really fast, but we plan on a 45 second outage for the batteries. Sure. Of course, you get to get rid of the data center rooms, so that's a pretty, you can see those battery rooms are pretty big. That's a lot of concrete, that's a lot of building space that you get rid of as well. Another implication of this is that your failure domain, what we call a failure domain, what goes down when any particular thing breaks, is greatly reduced. So, before we had redundant UPSs, we had redundant electrical feeds, we had to run everything redundant down to the servers, because any point along the way, something could break, and then you just need to fail over to the other guy. But when you move the batteries down into the servers, so for instance, let's say you still run dual powertrains down to the servers, but in the servers, you have what we call N plus N power. Our chassis, we have 6 power supplies. We'll run three on this feed and three on that feed. You know, we'll run three phase and it's all balanced and that sort of good thing. And but both feeds will have batteries. And so when you lose the or when you have a failure, it's just limited to one of the power supplies. So you just have the servers monitor everything locally. They say, hey, I got a bad, you know, it could just be, you know, it's treated the same as a power supply going bad. You know, say, hey, I got a bad battery, you know, please replace this power supply. And a technician comes out, replaces the power supply, and machine never goes down. And so if something really catastrophic happens, you know, the worst case is you have that one chassis with the six power supplies. That's the biggest thing that goes down. And so that enables us to work with our cloud software and, you know, kind of do some optimizations around placement of workloads and that sort of thing. And another good benefit of this is that it is pay as you go. When the data center, if you build a 10 megawatt data center, you put in 20, you know, for instance, 20 megawatts of UPSs, right? This, you know, if you end up filling up your data center and you only use, let's say, 8 megawatts of power, you can put in 8 megawatts worth of UPS. It's probably redundant, so maybe it's 16 megawatts, but it's not 20. And so it's definitely pay as you go. You know, you add the UPS as you roll in the equipment. One thing about batteries, though, you know, you wonder, are they safe? And are they low cost? And so we're riding a commodity wave for both safety and cost. So these are the same batteries that you'll find in, you know, in the Teslas, which are pretty cool, as well as a lot of power tools. And so the cost structure, you know, they deliver far more batteries into power tools than they do into the data center, right? There's a lot of batteries out there. And everything gets tested very thoroughly. You can see some pictures there on the side where they take those batteries and they run them in these machines that, you know, beat them and squish them and all these things, you know, just to make sure that they're chemically safe. We don't want to have any issues. And you know, the biggest thing with the lithium ion batteries is, you know, just making sure that you charge it appropriately. You don't overcharge them. You don't charge them too fast. And we have full control over all that. And everything is very safe. We've been having great success with it. I wanted to show a picture of, in the data centers, bringing the servers in and deploying them. So on the left-hand side, you can see, you know, the racks of machines. We bring in racks. We don't rack and stack in the data center. At our scale, when you have a million servers, basically, you got to bring everything in as a fully integrated, pre-integrated rack, I should say. It's got a network tower in there. Everything's all cabled up. These racks in these trucks can come in. They can be over 1.5 tons of weight. So the data centers are built with loading docks, the semi-trucks back in. You know, they wheel them off. The center picture, you see them getting them ready. You know, they're taking all the cardboard off, making sure everything's all ready. And then finally, you get them into the data center. You know, they wheel them in. You know, it's interesting, you know, you got to have casters that can handle, you know, 1.5 tons of weight on your racks. But they wheel them in, they bolt them down, and then they energize them, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, you plug in the power cords and hook up the fiber and turn them on and test it out. Make sure nothing shook loose while it was in the truck, and off you go. It's a very fast process. When we talk about operations, you know, a lot of time there's repair. So most people, or many people, are familiar with crash carts. You know, technician goes out, hey, my server went down. You know, you go out, you log into the machine, you look for the logs, you try to pull it off, you try to figure out what's going wrong. You know, maybe the machine won't boot. You know, you plug in a KVM, try to figure out from the boot screen or from a BMC what's going on. That's the way many people are used to doing it, but that's very intense operations from people. So when you're talking, when you're talking a million servers or more, you know, complexity is created by just the sheer scale. You can't be doing that to every server. You've got to do all this stuff by software. Plus, it's a safety, or not a safety, a security hazard. You know, if I allow every technician to be able to log into our machines, well, can't they be copying your data and that sort of thing? You know, we've seen a lot of, at this conference, we've seen a lot of emphasis and discussions about how we can use BitLocker to encrypt your data and to keep it safe and that sort of thing. We don't actually allow technicians to have access to our machines in the data centers. We don't even put connection paths for the technicians to get to the machines. It's kind of strange, right? But what we have is automated. Okay, where is it? All right. What we have is automation tools that go through and figure out, you know, that do a first pass triage on what's wrong with the machine. So what I show there is a state diagram for one of our services. This is like in the Bing service. You know, they'll actually go off and automatically, you know, they have a little service running in there. It's the autopilot, what they call autopilot, and it's doing like a phone home service, right? And it's talking to the service, and if the machine quits pinging, then the home goes off and says, hey, this machine didn't check in. It goes out and it tries to contact it. If it can't contact it, it goes out and it hammers it. It'll just reboot it. There's a large number of bugs. I'm told things like hard drives just kind of magically come back when you power cycle them many times. And so the Bing, the autopilot software, will actually try a full power cycle of the machine three times. And if it doesn't come back after the third time, then it'll say, okay, reimage it. Just flatten it, wipe it out. You know, so if something, let's say your OS boot disk got corrupted or something like that, it'll just reformat the drive and try rebooting. So it'll try that. If that fails, then they'll go off and put it on the queue for repair. But we have automated tools that'll go off and pull in like all the event logs and that sort of thing, and they'll create a trouble ticket, you know, electronic record, send it off to a technician and say, hard drive 3 is missing. You know, hard drive 3 is bad. It's not showing up. I can't get to hard drive 3 anymore. Please replace hard drive 3. So the technician just goes out. Actually, there's a step before that. Before that, for security and safety, the machine will actually go off and securely erase everything on the machine. I think in most cases, they wipe everything before a technician is ever told to even look at the machine. But then the technician is told, hey, this, you know, go to this rack and this row and this data center and replace hard drive 3. They'll replace it, they'll plug it back in, they'll go in and they'll check it off electronically, and then Autopilot or the Azure Fabric or whichever service is running internally will go and it'll pull the machine back in and it'll try to, you know, reimage it and get it up and running again. If for some reason it's, you know, not something so simple as, hey, a hard drive didn't show up, because hard drives are, I believe, number one failure rate item, so I love to pick on them. They're mechanical, right? Mechanical things fail more often than solid state things. So that's just the way it is. And so I love to pick on hard drives. But if it can't figure out what's wrong, you know, then they'll tell the technician, hey, we don't know what's wrong with this. Take it to the back room. The technician will take it off on, instead of running a crash cart out there in the aisle, will take it to the back room where you can have somebody who's experienced with really debugging these machines. You know, does it need a new motherboard or what? You know, they can put it in a machine and test it out and repair it in the back room. So now, finally, let's actually start talking even more about the hardware. So the systems that we built are very, very simple. So complexity is created by scale. And when you have more than a million servers, you know, that's a big issue to deal with all in itself. And so what you want to do is you want to make everything as simple as possible and push everything into software. You know, if you can, move it into software. And so the chassis that we built, this is one of the Open Cloud Server chassis. It's you know, many times, you know, I think of it as kind of a primitive chassis, right? It delivers power. It delivers cooling. It's got fans in the back. And it delivers a bare-bones management subsystem. And the power is very high efficiency, you know, so that we keep our PUE numbers, our overheads low. And the cooling is very efficient. We use big fans to keep the airflow, or to keep the electricity used in the fans as low as possible. But we had to standardize things. You know, the only way that you can actually effectively create all these standardized, you know, operations and that sort of thing is to have, you know, one interface into the data center. So we have in-house we have multiple different management software tools that are used across different teams. And if we create just one interface, it doesn't matter which vendor supplies the hardware, as long as they work with that interface, then we're in good shape. Then we can manage it. We can run diags. We can do whatever we need. And we need these chassis to be what we call contract manufacturing ready. So these chassis, we actually have them built from two different manufacturers. They're identical. You can't tell them apart. And so that's for supply chain reasons. You know, make sure you not only do you need redundancy in power and redundancy in cooling, but you need redundancy in your supply chain, just in case, you know, there was a ship that caught fire last year or something like that, shut down a port. It's like, oh boy. So you go to the other supplier and say, hey, while these guys are offline, you know, can we get equipment from the other suppliers? You know, so that's important. And of course, you know, these standardized interfaces make it so that we have one set of documentation for maintenance around the globe, you know, with people with different languages and that sort of thing. It makes all the training much simpler. So shown here is one of our storage servers. We've got 10 hard drives on this server. It's a very modular system, so you know we've got this rack infrastructure. It's a 12U chassis, but this is just plugs into 1U, and so this is the type of system that we would use. Well, it's used in one of our storage applications, and what the application would typically do, it's got 12 hard drives. They'll say, well, we'll use like 9 or 10 of the hard drives, and we'll keep a couple of spares. Just keep a couple of spares, and they'll run their application. And when a hard drive fails, and then they'll say, okay, we'll just swap in one of the drives. And when they get to the point, I think usually the threshold when 4 hard drives are bad, then we call the technician out and say, hey, replace these 4 hard drives. You know, replace these groups of hard drives. And you know, but the entire server comes offline. We're putting in the latest of the Intel processors on this server. They're 135 watt processors. We've got 40 gigabit networking. Everything is, we've gone from 1 gig to 10 gig to 40 gig just in the past, I don't know, 6 to 8 years. It's been a very rapid evolution. 50 gig is very, you know, is just around the corner, and then 100 gig will be out. Networking has changed super fast. We've also got, if you saw Monday's keynote, the FPGAs, the AI supercomputers. We've got a Vi 16 interface that we'll have for that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. So we have an interface for that. And we're big on flash drives. So we use quite a bit of flash. We use it for caching. We use it for premium storage offerings that you may have seen. And we're using what we call the M.2 form factor. It's a little stick. What we buy are 110 millimeters long. It's about 4 inches. And it's a little over an inch tall. I think they're 20, or a little under an inch tall. They're about 22 millimeters high. And we've chosen this form factor over, for instance, SSDs or U.2s because they're skinny and we can stuff them into the servers like you stuff in DIMMs. They're good for airflow. They're nice granularity. If we say, hey, I just want 1 terabyte, you just put in one stick. If you want 6 terabytes, you put in 6 sticks. You know, we can put, I think, 6 or 8 sticks of flash onto this server that you're looking at right here. And they're extremely high performance. So these flash drives, we call it the Cloud SSD, they're NVMe, they're PCI Express by 4 Gen 3, which is about 3 to 4 gigabytes per second of raw bandwidth on the bus. Well, the flash devices, the little NAND flash devices can't provide that much bandwidth. And so what we've done is we moved the bottleneck down to the actual flash devices itself. And so if you compare it to a SATA SSD, the SATA SSDs, you know, they've got the SATA wires as the bottleneck. You know, that's your bandwidth limit. And so what you end up getting is, significant improvements like 13x for reads, even 29x for read-write IOPS, mixed traffic configurations. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to get the middleman out of the way and go, get our bandwidth all the way straight from the flash. And so, I'm pretty happy when we started down this path, we're a little nervous about, okay, is M.2 really the right direction to go? Should we go in U.2s or, because those are also NVMe devices too, right? And they're also they share this, a lot of the same performance attributes that these do. But the form factor was just so difficult to work with for U.2s. And there weren't many M.2s, but we helped drive the M.2 market. And, I'm happy to see that, you can go off onto the internet and just search for them, and you can buy them as consumer versions of these today. So that's when you know something's actually made it as a standard, is, you can go off and buy it on the internet. So the management, I talked quite a bit about the management. So we've got chassis and rack management. It's all standardized. We've got, you see in the center there is our chassis manager. We use the chassis manager inside of this OCP, what we call the Open Cloud Server chassis. We also use it in some other specialized deployments as a rack manager. But that provides our standardized interface. We have one set of software running on it. We have a standard API. It provides all the monitoring of the chassis. It does all the, your power supplies. Hey, your battery's bad. A power supply is bad. A fan is bad. It also, talks to the servers, gathers information like for fan control. The way the fan control works is the server will say, hey, I'm getting hot. I need the fans set higher. I need them set to this level. And the chassis manager will look across all of the servers and it'll manage the fans. Manage the fans for you, and it's kind of the gateway into the what we call the BMCs, the base management controllers, to gather event logs and get the health of the servers themselves. So you can get console and things like that. So when we look at the actual management operations that you run, of course you need Ethernet connectivity. We also need serial connectivity. When we first roll in those racks into the data center, we turn them on, we power them up. None of the networking is all there, but none of it's set up or anything, and so you don't actually have a network. So how do you talk to your servers? Typically, we still talk to them via serial. And so, but across, you know, Ethernet is the way you usually use it, but you could do a command line interface. We support OpenSSH. Redfish is the latest management standard for how you talk to servers and that sort of thing. But on-off is probably the most prevalent control that we do. We turn our servers, in the previous picture, you know, we had the server, we take the entire server down when we say off. You know, we want to emulate as if you pulled the plug, you know, if it was a pizza box and you just pulled the plugs and the machine went dark. Because you never know if there's a problem, maybe there's a bug in your BMC and it's hung up. And if you're trying to talk to the BMC and say, hey, power cycle the server, and you can't talk to the BMC, well, then you're stuck, right? But we can hammer the entire blade, take everything down, power cycle the whole works. But, of course, also we have the path into the BMC, the base management controller, that gets us all the logs and that sort of thing. But with that, you know, you have to be able to image the management. You have to be able to deal with firmware. You have to be able to recover firmware. You know, if you have a problem, you have to be able to roll back. You know, all of that's handled. But you know, firmware in a box, actually, you know, with the big emphasis on security, firmware is actually something that we have to be very, very careful with. And so, you know, there have been a number of high-profile incidents where hackers actually attack the firmware, and not just attacking your machine, but they attack the firmware and they corrupt your base platform. And once your base platform is corrupted, man, you know, you never know what's going to happen. And so, with our emphasis on securing the platform, you know, we sign everything, all our drivers, all our firmware, everything gets signed. You know, we have security reviews, we do our own compilations and all that sort of thing. We're transitioning over to UEFI, that's Universal Extensible Firmware Interface, I think, but that enables all the secure boot. We deploy trusted TPMs, Trusted Platform Modules. Those are, for key management, for securing the platform. You know, you got to create, in the security circles, you got to create what they call a root of trust. You know, like your BMC, I think, is the first thing that boots on the server. And you got to know that BMC is not running compromised code. And so through signing and all of these things, we can make sure that root of trust is good. And so, you know, the BMC boots, then he allows the processor to boot, but then the processor firmware has to go through the same, through some of the same mechanisms of making sure that its firmware is trusted as well. And of course, you know, we have to go up and provide security all the way, you know, across Ethernet and all that. So, you know, if you have administrators and that sort of thing, you know, we use Active Directory and, you know, we do all this authentication and that sort of thing to make sure that everything's secure. So that's kind of the base platform. You know, one thing that I wanted to talk about that's kind of fun is what was announced on Monday at Satya's keynote was Azure's the world's first AI supercomputer. So this is a video of the picture search that was demonstrated there, where I believe it was 8 or 10x performance increase by utilizing one FPGA versus one server. So what's happening in the cloud is that the processors keep getting more and more powerful, more and more cores. And you know, you have Moore's Law, where they keep doubling the number of transistors and that sort of thing, and they keep piling more capability into the server. So the servers get more powerful, but they run software. There's a lot of algorithms, especially machine learning and other sorts of accelerators that really do better with direct optimized hardware. You could go down the path of building your own chips, building your own silicon, and optimizing your hardware that way. And then you have the absolute fastest optimized algorithm you could have. But if you do that, you've optimized one algorithm. It's taken you, you know, 2-3 years to do it. You have one algorithm, and it costs you millions of dollars. The path that Microsoft has chosen is to use FPGA cards. So these are called field programmable gate array cards. I've got a couple of these cards here. And you know, afterwards, you know, you can come up and look at them. These are essentially the same card. It's just two different form factors. This is a mezzanine connector, and this is a regular adding card. And the field programmable gate arrays allow you to program your own hardware, program your own algorithms. And probably the best thing of this is it allows us to create different types of accelerated services quickly and easily, you know, so it's differentiated. So what you see here is a convolutional neural network algorithm that's used for the image search, right? But you can do, you know, deep neural networks. You know, Bing, I think they've published studies where they've done ranking algorithms in Bing. But, you know, you go off and you write Verilog, which is a low-level code, or we use OpenCL, which is, you know, getting a little bit higher. That's more like writing C code. And you can compile that code, compile it, test it, download it, and run it. And we have different groups that are doing different algorithms for each of the different services. And so, you know, Bing is obviously using theirs for search. But another example is the networking team. You know, when you saw the announcement of accelerated, you know, the technical preview for hardware accelerated networking, we're doing what we call bump in the wire. And so what they've done is they've built an SRIOV interface, so a virtualized interface for the different VMs, where they allow a RDMA, you know, RoCE v2, RDMA over converged Ethernet version 2. So they allow you to do direct DMA from, you know, storage servers to your VMs, or from VMs to VMs, that sort of thing. And they have a preview in a couple of different types of VMs where they can deliver up to 25 gigabits per second using RDMA. And, you know, not only is it high bandwidth, but it's low latency, and you get rid of what we call the jitter. Jitter is basically variation. You know, does it take you 300 microseconds to get from here to there, or does it take you 300 milliseconds? You know, that's 299.7 milliseconds of jitter, right? So what you want is you want to reduce the variation as much as possible so that your applications, you know, have predictable performance. And so that's what hardware accelerated networking can get you. And so, you know, that's all at the base of it. You know, you've improved the performance of your base networking, reduce your latency, increase your bandwidth. But when you look at the application, you know, what really matters is when you get to the application. And so they have some examples of some databases where they're getting up to 50% more performance, 1.5x, because they're using the accelerated networking. Yes, question.
So I have a question. So you had these FPGA connections in the storage nodes as well. The previous picture that you showed for the storage node, that also had a connection to FPGA.
Yes. So the previous picture, in the Open Cloud Server, let's see. That's the 40 gig version. This is the 50 gig version.
Right.
That's what you see on the screen is the 40 gig version. This plugs into the back of the machine, and it talks directly to that server.
Right.
And so,
I mean, the storage context. Where is FPGA used? I mean, is there any storage workload that is accelerated?
Yeah, so the storage team, because they're storage, you know, they say, hey, we could do compression. Cool, we can put it, you know, we can accelerate compression. We can accelerate, you know, they do, essentially they do a erasure encoding across racks, right? So you take your, like if you get a gigabyte of blob storage, right? You'll take that gigabyte and you'll spread it all across racks and you'll make it, you know, do these encodings such that if an entire rack goes down, you still have the data, right? You know, it goes back to your failure domain, right? Okay. So the really cool thing about this is that, you know, the storage teams, they're thinking about compression, they're thinking about encryption, they're thinking about erasure encoding. The Bing search team is thinking about, you know, image search. They're thinking about ranking, getting better results when you do a search. You know, the networking team is accelerating their performance. You know, it's each team is doing something a little bit different with it.
Okay, great, thank you.
All right, thanks. So, you know, the previous version, you know, it looked like we had two network connectors coming out, and this one only has one, right? That's because we actually integrated the NIC straight onto the board. So this is our FPGA. This is the latest of the FPGA cards on here. We have 8 gigabytes of DRAM directly down on the board, and we have a NIC that's running to it, and we run a PCI Express by 8 cable up to this NIC. And so the application has local storage, high bandwidth local storage. It's got DMA, direct memory access, you know, straight back into the server. And it's got the networking path. And so for the accelerated networking, of course, you're running your network traffic to the NIC like you normally do, but it goes through the FPGA where they you know, set up flow tables and things like that for the SRIOV, you know, for the virtualized VMs. But the Bing guys use the BI-16 interface, predominantly use a BI-16 interface straight into the FPGA, and they use the local memory for their acceleration. So it's pretty capable on many fronts. So when we've gone through all of this, basically, you know, what we've seen is standardizing our servers, building our own servers. You know, we've seen up to about a 40% cost reduction over the years compared to if we're still doing rack and stack individual servers. You know, that they're lower cost, they're more efficient. You know, because we can tailor the fan algorithms and such straight to our data centers. And they enable us to more quickly onboard our servers, you know, bring them in racks at a time. But, you know, probably the best part of this, and, you know, when we started it all, we said, yeah, we can optimize our servers for Microsoft's use, is we can do things like build the AI supercomputer with FPGAs. Once we create standards and standardized interfaces, you know, then we can start building on top of those standards to provide value to our customer base. So if you want to know more about Azure, if you want to become an IT pro, you know, there's a number of things you can do. You know, if you you can take classes, you can try out Azure. You know, we've had you know, many of the demos out there. You know, I actually, after Monday's keynote, I've been going in and I've been taking machine learning demos every day because I'm a hardware guy. Face it, I don't really write software anymore. I do spreadsheets and PowerPoint, right? But I've been experimenting. I've been playing with that. All those machine learning, man, that's fun. It's fun stuff. But you can become an expert in this. You can get help and you can get assistance. We also have links out there on how you can do it. And, you know, so as you wrap up your day, as you finish up, please do evaluations, you know, for this talk, of course, and for any of the other talks that you've had. You know, we really appreciate your feedback. So thank you. So Any more questions or? All right.
I have a question about what do you do with the boot disks for your service? Do you have like the usual deployments with two mirrored boot disks, or do you network boot the nodes, or how do you optimize that in hyperscale?
Yeah, the boot disks, it's pretty interesting. What we've done in the vast majority of like our Azure compute nodes is they're just filled with flash, right? And then we put one little lone hard disk out there just for the boot disk and for logs. And no RAID, no nothing. If that boot drive dies, well, you got to fix it. But if you're only, you know, the failure rate of hard drives is really a function of how many times you access the disk. And if you're only using it for the occasional log and for boot drives, then they're actually quite reliable. And so they work pretty well for that. I think some of the other services, I don't think any of them use flash drives. I think they'll all probably just use a single hard drive.
And one more question.
Sure.
When you use your batteries inside the hot racks, does it influence the lifetime of the batteries compared to having it in a separate UPS room with lower temperatures?
Yeah, so the lifetime of the batteries is directly related to the charge cycles. So if you're using your laptops, I always tell myself, don't ever let the battery go too low, right? Because that deep charge discharge is what reduces your battery life the most. Our batteries, you know, we design them for, you know, a certain number of power cycles, and, you know, we look across the data centers and we look at yearly averages for usage and that sort of thing, and they should be in the 5 to 7 year lifetime range. You know, if you get a lot of thunderstorms or something like that, particularly 1 year, you know, then it might creep back from the 7 down to the 5 years, but if you're in a stable power environment, then it's probably 7. But the power supplies themselves actually have to go off and self-monitor inside the health of the batteries. And so if for some reason, you know, like a battery does start to get weak, it'll actually, you know, flag it out to the management system.
Thanks.
Sure.
First, thank you. This has been great today, really interesting for me. I'm curious if what your replacement strategy is, and like, do you wait till they fail and then you get rid of them, or do you proactively replace them? And then when you do start replacing, what the heck are you going to do with those millions of servers as they turn in?
Yeah. So the servers themselves, we usually repair machines. It's not very common that we just let them, you know, fail in place or rot, that sort of thing. But we do have thresholds for repair, like for hard drives and that sort of thing. You know, our big storage systems, you know, big boxes, lots of hard drives, those are all online repair and that sort of thing. When machines get decommissioned, this is what we call it, you know, I think the people who decommission the machines would love to be able to sell them on the open market, but usually the hard drives are worn and tired out, or tired and worn and, you know, about ready to just bomb out anyways. And you know, I think a lot of equipment goes to recycling. You know, by the time, you know, if you go 3, 4, 5 years, the new boxes are 2 to 4 times more performant than the old boxes. And so people just aren't interested in them. So, thanks. Yes.
How do you monitor silent data corruption in your FPGAs? Like, at the scale you guys deploy, you probably get alpha particle, like, bit switching.
Yeah, well, if it's silent data corruption, how are you going to know if it's silent?
Exactly.
No, you can, you know, if it's critical structures, you can put parity on them. You know, like if you're doing, let's say, line rate encryption, right? What you do is encryption or compression, you actually go off and you do the compression, And you don't say that's good enough, right? You actually uncompress it and compare it to the original data. And so if there's actually a bit flip in there somewhere, it's going to be caught as something, and it's going to say, hey, retry the operations and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's up to the people who are writing the code to recognize, hey, this data is critical. You know, I need to parity protect it or whatever. You know, use some other detection algorithm. More. All right. Well, thank you, and feel free to come up, and we can look at the FPGAs.